All right. While I'm getting set up, if you'd like to, turn in your scriptures to the book of Leviticus, Vayikra. And then after you've done that, you can find chapter 21, and that's about where we're going to be tonight, although I will admit it, we're going to be all over the place a little bit, and I'll tell you why in just a second. But we'll begin with at least what the portion begins with. The portion is called Emor, and because, of course, you know, that's the way that in the Hebrew the first kind of unique words in here go. The first line of chapter 21, verse 1, is something we hear over and over and over again. And it says, "And Yahuwah spoke the Emor Yahuwah al Moshe," in the Hebrew. "And Yahuwah said unto Moshe," and then we get some quotes, at least in the English, and he says the following. Here comes the unique word. "Speak, say, Emor, unto the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them." Wait a minute. Let's pause there. Now, this is where sometimes the sages will say, this is a little bit of an unusual structure. Did you notice that a lot of times we're told that very same starting phrase, "And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe," or "said unto Moshe." But then the second line is different. And rarely do we see the word "speak" or "say" or "emor" twice, like we do here. What's going on? Well, the thing that they're told to say first is, you're not to defile yourself for the dead. None of the priests are to defile themselves for the dead. Now, I think that's kind of funny. We kind of understand what that means, maybe. Maybe we don't. Obviously, there's a little bit of a pagan reference in there. Are people defiling themselves, doing various things for the dead among their people? Whatever it was that they did, you're not supposed to do that. I guess, just by way of introduction, I might suggest, interesting. Is it possible there's a little bit of a double entendre as we think about this scripture and apply it to modern days? I look out at society, and I see a whole lot of folks that arguably, at least when it comes to their relationship with Yod Heh-Vav-Heh, are spiritually dead. Is that what they're talking about? Well, I'm going to ask more questions again than answers. But I do want to emphasize this "speak" thing, because there's a whole lot of stuff here besides that that he is telling them to teach, to speak, to say to Aaron and to his sons, the priests, the Levites. One of those things is this. Essentially, when you see this idea of "speak" and "say" and repeated, it's just possible that that the reason why it's a double "speak" is because of emphasis. Nowadays, of course, what we have instead of speaking and making the emphasis, we have double "speak" in the Orwellian sense. Another thing that the Midrash will suggest, and I like this, is that what this is at least starting out to advise us is, it's important. Hey, you Levites, you priests, you are to teach your children. Speak, speak, speak. Certain things are important. Teach them. And as we go through the portion tonight, that's what I'm going to emphasize, because I'm going to suggest to you that we failed. That not only did the priests fail repeatedly, but we've continued to fail. And hey, you know, as Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun anyway. This is old news. It's just that it's important that we emphasize it. And in particular, because one of the things we keep hearing is all this old stuff, especially Leviticus. I mean, that's got to be the most boring book in Scripture. I don't know how many times I've heard that. Boring. Doesn't apply anymore. Well, you know what? If we believe that, take a look around at society and see one of the things that seems to be the bitter fruit of that coming out here. All right. Here is where I depart from the normal procedure on Erev Shabbat just a little bit more. A lot of times, most of you know, on Erev Shabbat, what I'll try to do is to go through the Torah portion in a little bit more detail. And then typically on the longer teaching on Boker Shabbat on Saturday morning, I'll go into more detail on some specifics and focus on a couple of things and a little bit more freeform. But tonight I'm going to do a little bit of that on Friday night as well. And part of the reason, not the whole reason, has to do with the fact that in this time of season, there are a lot of congregations, fellowships, both Orthodox, Rabbinic, Jews, and others, messianics, and all kinds of other people that are teaching the yearly Torah cycle that are in different places, in part because of the way of the calendar and the fact that somehow or other we ended up a week different in some cases, counting the Omer. I've already kind of mentioned that here. So as a result, there are a lot of folks that are still teaching Achrimot, the double portion we talked about last week with Kedushim, and some are in Emor, but probably more are the other way. And I'd like to at least try to kind of sort of get back in line just so that we can be as many as possible on the same page. That's not nearly as big of a deal as my other excuse for wanting to do what I'm going to do tonight, and that is because there's so much going on and so many things that I think are important. I really want to combine some of the lessons from this entire section. We're actually talking about three different Torah portions in Vayikra and Leviticus that have to do with teaching and with things that are appropriate to the priests and things that are appropriate to the set-apart places and all kinds of stuff that in general we've been hearing in many cases, especially in the Sunday churches, for a lot of our lives. Oh, this doesn't matter anymore. It's done away with. Hey, the temple isn't here anyway. Can't do this. Now, there is some truth in that. The problem is the 80-20 rule. You want to get people to believe a lie, mix it with the truth, and they'll swallow it like Kool-Aid that's got just a little bit of rat poison in it. So, here's how I'm going to start. By the way, one of the things I'm going to get to is the Haftorah portion tonight as well, too. That comes from Ezekiel chapter 44. And it fits all of this. So here we go. This is going to be a really, really brief overview of the whole thing. It starts out with, as we've already said, speak unto the priest and say, speak, speak. Does that mean teach your children? I suggest it does. Don't defile yourself for the dead, you sons of Levi. Shouldn't be any of those among your people, unless it's really near kin, mother, father, son, daughters, brothers, and so forth. Or maybe your virgin sister. Don't profane yourself. Oh, there's some other little stuff. Don't make baldness upon your head. They, in short, shall be set apart unto Elohim and not profane his name. Okay? There is a little bit of a higher standard that's set for certain things that might seem a little bit strange to us nowadays, especially since what we're doing is destroying the standards completely. We'll get back to the Supreme Court in just a minute. You are not to take a woman that is a harlot or profaned or someone who is put away. Now, put away would obviously mean she's married if she doesn't have a get. But in this case, the put away would be legitimately put away, what we would say in English, divorced from her husband. She is set apart. Nope. He, the priest, is supposed to be set apart. So the higher standard is basically he needs to take a woman in her virginity. And then it repeats this. Widowed, divorced, profaned woman, harlot, none of those. Just a virgin of his own people he's supposed to take. We're verging into some stuff that is politically incorrect with that because, hey, who cares about virginity anymore? It's a red badge of shame now if somebody is, I don't know, what is the age, 13 years old and not yet consummated it or done, you know, whatever the president showed in the Oval Office you could do with a blue dress years and years ago. In other words, we've moved a whole long way from all of this kind of stuff. But just wait. When it comes to politically incorrect stuff, we're getting there in verse 17. Speak to Aaron and say to him, you know what? Dwarves? People that are blind or lame or has maimed parts or something that's too long? In other words, a blemish? Those folks are not to be going into the holy place and performing some of these services. No man of the seed of Aaron the priest that has a blemish shall come nigh to offer the offerings of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh made by fire. He has a blemish. He is not to come nigh. Whoa! What, doesn't he know about the Americans with Disabilities Act or any of that kind of stuff? Who is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to tell us who is allowed to go into his most holy set-apart place? Answer, he wrote the rules. He can do whatever he wants, and the goal ought to be, are we writing the rules, or is he? Who's the one that's in command here? And I guess that's the general point that I'm going to come back to on a number of occasions this evening. Yeah, it's not politically correct, and you know what? Tough. You are not to profane my set-apart name, it says. And not only that, these people that go in to approach the set-apart things, the things that are kadosh, are supposed to be clean in a way that they haven't associated themselves, haven't touched dead things. And there's a number of little bit higher standards that are listed there. Chapter 22 repeats some of these things. Man, if he's a leper, he has an issue. He's not even to eat of the holy things until he is clean. The priest's family, those that he has purchased with his money, his indentured servants, those can eat of these set-apart things. Then we get on to the animals, the things that are going to be offered up. And it says again that anything that has a blemish, you're not to bring, at least not when it comes to the offerings by vow. If you have a bull or a lamb that has something a little too long or too short, that one can be offered for a free will offering, but not for a vow. There are some more specifications. Then we get on to chapter 23. Now, this is one I'm going to linger on just a little bit. It is something we've heard before. And one of the things that he suggests, more than suggests, he commands over and over again, that I will emphasize whenever the opportunity arises, and here we are, is that the set-apart times, the appointed times, the feasts of Yah. Now, I have no problem with, Orthodox Jews saying these are Jewish feasts. Great. But let's not be exclusive here. These are really his feasts. It's great that you keep them. But you know what? We're supposed to be keeping them if we want to be grafted into Kol Israel, period. Because he keeps telling us over and over again, these are my feasts. Now, I particularly like the phraseology in chapter 23, verse 2. Chapter 23, verse 1 says, And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, we've heard that before, Speak unto, this time it's the children of Israel, B'nai Israel, and tell them, say to them, these appointed seasons of Yahuwah, which you shall proclaim to be set apart, kadosh convocations. Now listen to this. It changes from the third person, the appointed seasons of Yahuwah. These are my feasts. Moadai. There we go. Moadai. They're mine. Let's pause on that for a second. These are my feasts. Can the Jews lay claim to them? Yeah, in a way. Should those who claim to be followers of Yah in any form, that would include ex-Jews, Christians, whether they know that they have moved away from it or not, you bet. He says, these are mine. And then he lists them again. And they're listed in here a bunch of times for 6 days shall work be done. Seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. Don't do any work. It's a Sabbath unto Yahuwah in all your dwellings. These, and then he lists them again, the set apart annual feasts, the ones that come once a year. These are the appointed seasons of Yahuwah, which you shall proclaim in their appointed season. Now, how do we start this? We started this with a discussion about the Levites who are supposed to teach their children. Speak to the priests. Say to them, here's some things to do. And then one of the things, of course, that they're going to be required to do, and Ezekiel is going to confirm that for us, is to teach the things that they're supposed to teach. This stuff is written for us for a reason. Now, I like, but I'm not going to go through in detail, some of the things that people like Rabbi David Foreman do such a great job of pointing out. If you look at the patterns in here, and I'm a big guy for patterns and repeating cycles and all that kind of jazz, but as he observes, you will note lots and lots and lots of sevens. Starts with sevens. Every 7 days you got my Sabbath. Now, of course, the church for years has done away with that, said you keep his Sabbath, you're anathema to us. And even those that are protesting Catholics don't realize it, but they ain't protesting enough. Shakespeare said, I think, she doth protest too much. I think they doth protest not nearly enough because they're missing the whole point. Again, if these aren't his feasts, who's the liar? The church or the creator of the universe and author of Scripture? So you got various kinds of things that are patterns of seven and ones. 6 days shall work be done. That's seven minus one. But the seventh day, there's the seven, is a day of solemn rest. And then here you go. First month, 14th day of the month. That's first month, 2 times 7 days. At dusk is Pesach. 15th day, 2 times 7 plus 1. The same first month is the feast of unleavened bread unto Yahuwah. 7 days you're to eat unleavened bread. Are you starting to see the pattern? Okay, and then it goes through a whole lot of detail. Seventh day, then we talk about the 7 times 7 plus 1 that lead up to Shavuot. What does it tell us here, by the way, several times in this stretch? This is a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. Any questions? Oh, that's done away with. Well, excuse me, where does he say this is no longer a statute forever in all your generations throughout your dwellings? Yeah, people did get kicked out of the land. Why? Because they weren't listening, weren't doing what he said. Would they like to get back in? You got a lot of the church that's claiming, we are the bride of Christ. Well, it ain't a virgin bride. She sure as heck isn't cleaned up yet. She isn't keeping his feast. She isn't much of a bride at all. I will suggest that she ain't ready, or even close. And we'll come back to that in just a second, because there's an interesting observation that I think we ought to be making here pretty quickly on that score. But we're going to finish this quick overview first. Statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling place. It appears several times through here. We wave the first fruits of the wave offering. Make a proclamation. No manner of servile work. Verse 21. It is a statute forever in all your dwellings throughout your generations. Then seventh day of the month. That is to be proclaimed with a shofar blast. You could call it Yom Teruah, the day of the shofars or the shouting. Don't do any servile work. Bring an offering made by fire. 10th day, 7th month, is the Day of Atonement. Afflict your souls. No manner of work. If you do, you are to be cut off. Guess what? That one, too, is a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. Now, do you hear the church talking about the fact that if you don't keep the Day of Atonement, this set-apart day, and if you do work on it, that you get cut off? No. Well, don't worry about it. They're already cut off. The problem is, we got lots of other claims that people will build on it, and I'm working up to that. Let me just suggest one of them is we're supposed to be a nation of priests, right? You'll hear that. You'll see that in the Torah. You'll also hear the more Catholic version of it, of the order of Melchizedek. I'll come back to that in a second. Priests and kings. Well, it would seem to me that those who aren't doing the things he says to do and that are walking and whoring and aren't even fit to be a bride of a priest, much less the priest himself, probably can't claim to be ready to be a virgin bride. More political incorrectness. Okay. I think you get the pattern. And that's where I want to pause there for a second. Verse 1 of chapter 24, Yahuwah again spoke to Moshe saying, I'm going to have the children of Israel bring pure olive oil beaten for light to cause a lamp to burn continually. Interesting. Of course, you know that there's a parable that's told about 10 virgins, not just one, but 10. 5 of them ain't ready. They don't have any oil for their lamps, spiritual or otherwise, whatever that means. So, you know, maybe they ought to start looking back through here and seeing what it says. Aaron is to order it from evening to morning before Yahuwah continually. It's to be another one of these things, say it with me, a statute forever throughout your generations. Lamp for the light. You know what the metaphors having to do with light and oil and all that kind of stuff are. I guess it's it shouldn't be lost on us. It is from the children of Israel, it says, an everlasting covenant. It is a perpetual due. Funny, after all of that, the portion ends with a little story that starts in verse 11. But the son of an Israelitish woman who blasphemed the name, the set-apart name of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and cursed somehow or other. And they brought this fellow into Moshe. And they basically asked what needs to happen with him for blaspheming the name. Answer, he was going to be put to death. Stoned. There's a principle that's outlined here, and it's one we've talked about before, too. Breach for breach, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. In other words, without going into a lot of detail, it's not necessarily you go put out somebody's eye for crying out loud. No, it's talking about really what has been referred to as measure for measure. Generally, when we're talking about making things right, the Torah is big on making things right. Sometimes if you steal or do something that causes harm, not only do you make it right, you add more to it. kind of depending on a number of things. But the concept still is to make it right. And in a lot of cases, you can't make right certain things that are very destructive and can't be fixed. What you can do is at least try economically to restore what was lost in one way or another as best you can and to heal the breach. So I will suggest that's what's going on here. The measure for measure thing is key. But then let's ask the question, well, what about someone who has literally killed the name of the Creator himself? It would seem that measure for measure, the implication is death. Now, I'm gonna let that sit there for a second and ask, what about those who have blasphemed the name? They don't even give the name anymore. They won't use it. They'll tell you, well, it's the Lord. They removed the name. And then they'll lie about what he said. Don't keep his appointed times. Don't do the things that he says to do. For crying out loud, does that amount to blaspheming the name? Now, I'll leave that as an exercise for the reader, but I'm going to suggest to you that at the very least, people need to start realizing that when we're doing things that are wrong, we've got to clean up our own act and start walking in obedience. However, the portion ends with this too. So here's the end of the summary. This is something I spent a lot of time talking about last week, and it really bugs me. And yeah, it's probably going to come up as we talk about some of the newsy things this week. Verse 22 repeats something that we see in chapter 12 of Exodus, and in Numbers twice, Numbers 15, 16, as well as later on. You're to have one manner of law. And by the way, this isn't Torah in this case. It's mishpat, statutes. One statute, set of statutes for the stranger as well as for the homeborn. In other words, for the folks that are in the land and the folks that are sojourning with you. For Ani Yahuwah Elohechem, I am the Lord your God, it says. Funny that that would show up right after we've talked about blaspheming the name, isn't it? Again, I will suggest there's a message there. It's a message that's been widely overlooked. Wow. What a contrast. Here's where I pause. And let's think about where to begin after a portion like that. And again, we started with Achremot and Kedoshim, a lot of instruction about things that were to be done. Then there was a lot of instruction that had to do with the prohibited sexual relationships. Let me start with this. I'm looking at a piece that I think does a pretty good job of outlining some of the distinctions. I'm going to depart from the text in a lot of ways, but this is just a way of introducing it. I've already kind of outlined a couple of elements of it here. A Nation of Priests. This is by Rabbi Ari Kahn. And he notes that if you go look at the entire book of Vayikra, Leviticus, the attention has been largely focused on the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and the rituals, the things that are to be performed in that. And the Mishkan, he says, was the epicenter, the focus of life. And he says the Jewish people, I'm going to change the wording here. This, remember, was not just Jewish people. This was Kol Israel. This was all of Israel. And it was in a geographic sense, while they were encamped in the desert, as well as in a symbolic sense, and as others have pointed out, he doesn't, but I'm going to mention it, this is a place in the midst of the congregation where there was a set-apart place for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. It's kind of like a mini turned-inside-out version of the Garden of Eden, which was a place in the creation that the Creator put man and set him apart so that he could tend to the garden, well, up until he blew it, walked in rebellion, and got kicked out. So as you've probably heard me talk about before, and many, many others as well, there is a lot of things in the portions here that really begin to, if we step back and look at them, give us kind of a bigger understanding. What's the point of the Mishkan? What's the point of all this stuff of being set apart? Why are there classes of people that do certain things and are supposed to teach and are supposed to minister in certain ways and to bring these offerings made by fire and so forth? Well, it seems to have this idea. And by the way, this gets Christianized too, right? Oh, the Holy Temple, the Holy of Holies is within us now. It's written on my hearts. I don't need that Torah thing anymore. Oh, really? Right, Jeremiah 31, 31. It's an easy verse to remember. That area talks about this new covenant. It's not really renewed, not a new covenant so much as a renewed covenant. And it says here that it'll be written on our hearts. But it also says it'll be no longer necessary for each man to teach his brother, because they'll all know me, he says, from the least of them to the greatest of them. All right, take a look around. Can you honestly make a case that that applies today? Look at the world, for crying out loud. Look at the Supreme Court this week asking the question, can we change the Constitution at will and rape the set-apart scriptures of the Almighty? Because he's not welcome in our courts. I guess we can do whatever we want to. We'll come back to that, too. Is the Mishkan in people's hearts? Are they a set-apart people? If they don't even keep the Sabbaths, his appointed times, that he says to keep forever, I will suggest there's a problem here somewhere. All right, back to Ari Kahn, because he makes this interesting comment. He says there's a dual focus in this entire discussion in Vayikra. This dual focus between the things that are done by the priest, the things that are geographical and the set-apart place, and the things that are in the wider community. And all of this might lead us to the conclusion that these laws of purity and impurity, the things that are enumerated here in this book, that much of Roman Catholicism, both protesting and in agreement with, would say are all done away with anyway. Well, that they don't even apply anymore. They're only appropriate insofar as the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is concerned. Outside the Mishkan, says the rabbi here, holiness is probably less important, if not altogether irrelevant. Well, probably he's going to disagree, so do I. Following the discussion on the Yom Kippur service, Achrimot then goes to an interesting place. It immediately transitions to this idea of those forbidden sexual liaisons. The shift of focus is abrupt, and if you think about it, it's significant. First and foremost, there was the paganism. Orgiastic celebrations and other sexually depraved practices were common elements of so-called religious cultic practice. And so, what the Torah did was create clear, immutable categories of permitted and forbidden relationships. Basically, the permitted ones had to do with marriage, covenant. Within covenant, all kinds of wonderful, joyful stuff is permitted. But when it comes to things that are outside of covenant or other relationships that are just forbidden completely, like adultery and incest and male-on-male sexuality and bestiality, it's no how, no way. Now, here's where he's headed. Yah's people were supposed to be not only a treasured nation, of course, a set-apart nation, but also a kingdom of priests. And this is from Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. It was the entire people, Kol Israel, men, women, and children, that were all, at least in theory. Now, here we could say, okay, is this a little bit of an extension or not? Well, to be a nation of priests, it would mean that everybody would have to be kind of like Kohanim, at least in one way or another. Now, are they sons of Zadok? Even among the Levites, we'll see that there are some distinctions made. There's going to be more that are made during the time of Exodus chapter 44 here. There were certain things in terms of rituals that could only be performed in the Mishkan or in the temple in later time. Yeah, it gets complicated. But nevertheless, the concept, at least, was this idea of a kingdom of priests. Now, as I've already mentioned, when you get to the New Testament, the apostolic writings, the thing that the church talks about, then we see a reference to Melchizedek, the king of Salem, Shalom, peace, as a matter of fact. And if you look at the word Melchizedek, or think of it this way, Melech Zadik, right? Two words, and now they're pretty obvious. Melech is king, Zadik is king of righteousness, or maybe it's the king of the wisdom of Torah, might be another way to put it. Kind of interesting. So whether you're talking about Rabbinic Orthodox Judaism, where people are going to be a nation of priests, or Orthodox ex-Christianity that does away with all that Old Testament stuff, but still claims somehow we're going to be priests and kings on the order of Melchizedek, we got a problem here. Let me just give you a couple of examples. We'll talk about just an item or two in the news, and then we'll pause, and we'll come back to this in a little while. But I've already alluded to the so-called Supreme Court. Now, I'm going to be real blunt here. The black robe priests of another god. Oh, is that too harsh? Well, Did you read what they were talking about this week? I've got two stories, and I'm not even sure which order to do these in. There were some discussions about the discussions. The press was telling us all about how these wizened priests of another god were deciding how they were going to put into print. No, we don't need print. We're just going to create it out of whole cloth. A new rite that didn't exist anywhere in Scripture, or much less in the Bill of Rights, before. A right to commit abomination before a god that they don't teach in their schools or let into their courts. All right, he calls it abomination. They say we're going to license it. What are we seeing here? What are we saying? It's funny. What bugs me about this? Let me read a couple of pieces of this. Okay. The Supreme Court's allegations and arguments on Tuesday over so-called same-sex marriage, this is from Reuters, will cap more than two decades of litigation and transformation in public attitudes. Got to convince the public that the thing that, that God that they're no longer allowed to teach anymore, what was it we started with, teach your children? Yeah, that one, you know, the one that's not welcome anymore. Well, we've transformed their minds. I mentioned the story from Hillary a couple weeks ago. Transform people. Get rid of all of those old religious ideas and all that stuff that's not acceptable anymore. There's a sense of inevitability in the air, says Reuters. A majority is on the verge of declaring gay marriage legal. Now, here's where I say there's a difference between legal and lawful, at least if you understand which God we serve. And that's why I'm making the distinction. Are we talking about the God of the Bible, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and His Word? No. No. Clearly, something is different. Are we talking even about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? Well, obviously not. Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Well, hey, aren't they doing that? Kinda. We'll come back to that. How about the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed? Well, we do that all the time. How about no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or what? Oh, come on. Give me a break. You go to an airport, we're going to grope your gonads. We're going to treat your little four-year-old daughter like she's not a virgin, and we're going to do it right here. Do we need a warrant? No. Do you have a right to privacy in your persons, houses, papers, and effects? Don't kid us. Something has changed. It's not just the God of the Bible that's not welcome. It's no longer one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. We got a class of people that are above the law. All right, so here you go. Back to Reuters and the story. Justice Anthony Kennedy, the court's pivotal member, this is the guy that they say will make the decision. He's been marching in this direction, and most recently he decried a law and a legal definition in the law. Now, by the way, if you go to the Constitution, ask yourself the question, where in there does the word marriage appear? Nowhere. Where in there in those 17 things that Article 1, Section 7, and then 8 and 9, 2 kind of talk about, is the authority, the power enumerated in any way, shape, or form to allow the central government to say squat about marriage? Or for that matter, education. That word doesn't appear either. Nowhere. It's just simply not there. So what's going on is something clearly different. Well, Kennedy basically said, look, we got this problem that somebody is trying to limit benefits to a man and a woman. So he deplored U.S. so-called law for making gay marriages unequal. The key here is, understand, folks, if you sign up for the king's benefits, you play the king's tunes. You take the king's licenses, the king's permits, the king's emoluments. The king is going to tell you how his slave is going to walk. If you play the king's money, you better play the king's tune. So what we've seen is this steady march, and Reuters is at least telling us partly the truth here. And the public is basically saying, we're ready for it. Yeah, we're ready to get rid of that old god altogether. Think back to the paganism and all these rituals and rites and things that were orgiastic celebrations. Hey, well, turn on a TV for crying out loud, and you'll see the celebrations of things that the creator of the universe says are abomination. The headline, by the way, in this piece was interesting. It says the USSC, well, this is my headline, is getting ready to declare a new rite. They're going to declare a new rite, a right to commit abomination and call it legal and licensed, and we're going to make those people who have taken our business licenses support it whether they like it or not. And at the same time, we're going to rub it in your face, or we're going to ignore all of those other rights that the Bill of Rights said were supposed to be sacrosanct. And they were written in genuine print to prove it. So if it's in print, we ignore it. If it's not in print, we'll make it up. And that brings me to this, just a quick note, that there's a piece from, I don't remember where this was, anyway, about the State Department and how they have a new envoy, kind of an ambassador, if you will, of human rights of gays and lesbians. It's called the Special LGBT Envoy Worldwide. Now get this, so the State Department has an envoy, literally, who's dedicated to going around the world and preaching that you, all of you other nations, must license abomination just like we do. And ask yourself the question, do they have an envoy for the right to keep and bear arms? For the right to be free of illegal searches and seizures? Well, can't have one of those because he'd be groped going through an airport. Ha ha. Do they have a right for warrants or an envoy for free speech or freedom of worship? No, we're getting rid of all that kind of stuff, including in our own military. Here's where I'm working up to. This one came out from a bunch of preachers, and I'm going to dare to suggest most of them are licensed preachers, too. And they warned, they bluntly warned the Supreme Court, said Fox News, that they had better not license gay marriage. Now, they didn't actually use the word license, because they're carefully avoiding that term, because guess what? They're licensed churches. But we'll come back to that, too. We respectfully warn the Supreme Court not to cross that line, said a document that they titled Pledge in Solidarity to Defend Marriage. Are they defending biblical marriage? No, clearly not. It's traditional marriage. That's the term that is going to be used here, because we like some things that God said, the Lord. We don't like all of it, so we're going to basically pick and choose. We stand united together in defense of marriage, it says. They'll make no mistake about our resolve. Oh, yeah? Well, we'll see. While there are many things we can endure, redefining marriage, said their statement, is so fundamental to the natural order and the common good that this is the line we must draw, one we cannot and will not cross. Excuse me. You already did. You crossed the line when you allowed Big Brother to redefine something that the creator of the universe already told you about a long, long time ago, and instead to license it at all. When some licensed preacher gets up in front and says, by the power invested in me by the state of Delaware, I declare, you to be man and wife. Show me one place in Scripture, one place ever, where any man of Yah ever goes and asks and gets permission or license from any priest, potentate, or justice of the peace. Never happens. They get permission from the fathers. There are three involved. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, you could call him the father, and the father of the bride, and the father who says, son, you're ready. Go get yourself a wife. The signees, it says here, are a group of so-called religious leaders, licensed all. And essentially, here's the issue. They're saying, you know, we might have to engage in acts of civil disobedience if you cross this line. There's a, who is this, Liberty Council, civil disobedience. I'm talking about resistance. I'm talking about peaceful resistance against unjust laws and unjust rulings. Wait a minute. You got a problem here. You've already taken their license. You've taken their money. In for a penny, in for a pound. Now, what are we really talking about? Let's get blunt here. What they're worried about, they may take away our tax exemption. They may take away my mints! They may take away my tax exemption, and then I won't have all the goodies. Ooh, now you've done it. Now you've done it, Supreme Court. You've threatened mammon. The licensed preachers of the licensed church are concerned that licensing marriage that they don't like, but they can't really go to Scripture, no, they're just going to call it traditional marriage, is a problem. I'm calling for people not to recognize the legitimacy of this ruling, because it's not grounded in the rule of law, said one of these guys. My comment, hey, come on. What does Scripture tell you? The remedy has come out of her. The remedy is to say, all right, you know, if I made a mistake in taking a license, whether it's marriage that gives my children to the Almighty State, or whether it's a licensed corporate church that gives control over what was supposed to be the church of the Almighty God to the church of the Almighty State, then maybe I better come out of her first. Does that mean I lose my tax exemption? Hey, put on your big boy pants and get over it. Now, I'm going to talk about a couple of other things on this score as we go through it here. But let's pause right there. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 44 for a second. We'll come back to this one after we do our the rest of the news and some of the things as well in a little while. But I at least want to introduce it, because Leviticus is the story we just did, Emor, has to do with the so-called instructions, mishpatim, ordinances, statutes that have to do with the priests, specifically the Levites. And that's why this is part of the Haftorah portion for tonight. That's exactly what this portion in Ezekiel is talking about too. Starts in chapter 44, verse 10. It says, "And the Levites who went far from me," these are the words in red, "when Israel went astray," who strayed away from me after their idols, "they shall bear their iniquity." Now let's pause. He's talking about Levites who strayed. These are people who failed to do what we've just said up front they're supposed to ought to be doing. Teach your children. Be set apart. Don't defile yourself for all kinds of things that are, well, I guess I'd say now, dead works. And we know what happened. There was a split, northern kingdom, southern kingdom, Israel and Judah, the two wives, the two sisters, Ahola and Aholibah. Israel went astray. And it turns out the Levites, of course, were all over the place. There were Levites in the north, Levites in the south. And we now see a division in this portion of chapter 44 between these two sets of Levites as well. So you've got some Levites that when Israel went astray, they strayed from me, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, after their idols, they shall bear their iniquity. Now, it says in verse 11, "They shall nevertheless be ministers in my sanctuary, as gatekeepers of the house and ministers of the house. They'll slay the burnt offerings and the sacrifice for the people stand before them. But because they ministered to them before their idols, and they caused the house of Israel to fall into iniquity, therefore I've raised my hand," says the creator and author of Scripture, "against them. They shall bear their iniquity, and they shall not come near me to minister to me as priests, nor come near any of my set apart things, nor into the most holy place, but they shall bear their shame and their abominations which they have committed." Now then, he says, there's going to be this distinction. The priests, the Levites, the sons of Zadok, who kept charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray from me, they shall come near to me to minister. "They shall stand before me to offer the fat and the blood," says Yahuwah. "They shall enter my sanctuary, and they shall come near my table to minister to me, and they shall keep my charge." So we've got a split here. And here's a verse that I keep coming back to, even when we're not talking about this specific part of the instruction. He repeats some of the commandments that we've already talked about in this parsha. And then he says this. This is Ezekiel 44, 23. "And they," these people, "they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, the tahor, the tameh, the kadosh, the profane, and they shall cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean." Now pause for a second there. This is so important. This is literally the essence. And by the way, this is exactly what's going on today. You got these black robe priests of another god that are out there teaching his people. No, they're not his people anymore. They've already gone astray. In a lot of respects, they're spiritually dead. They have gone after a whoring church for, well, God alone knows how long. They haven't been keeping his statutes, judgments, and commandments. They've been told the law is done away with, and for crying out loud, they're right. So far as they're concerned, they don't got no rights before God anymore. Not any of those things in the Bill of Rights. No, they got a whole separate law and a whole separate God, and these black-robed priests of that other God are rubbing their noses in it and making sure that if they don't understand it, at least they get the message. Written rights? No. The rights to commit abomination? Yeah, that's fine. Do they know the difference between the holy and the unholy, the set apart and the profane? Hell no. They've been lied to. They're calling evil good and good evil. They're licensing abomination. Any way you slice it, folks, this is so in your face that it's hard for me to believe that people aren't awakening and seeing it here. And what have you got? You got all these preachers of the 501c3 whore church standing up and saying, oh, we might have to say something about this. Oh, because we might lose our tax deduction. We want to keep our license. We want to continue to serve this God that's given us the good stuff. You priests of the north, you that were sent into exile for your whoring, you failed to teach my people the difference between the clean and the unclean, the holy, the set apart, and the profane, the unholy. Now, what do we got today? What is the highest ordeal, the highest goal? Right? We don't welcome the God into the schools anymore at all. No, we now teach that you're a bigot if you believe there's a difference, if you believe certain things are wrong. We'll call you a homophobe first, then we'll call you a bigot. In other words, the one thing you cannot do is have discernment. Well, it's called discrimination. We've given it a nice name. Discrimination between the clean and the unclean? No, that's verboten. I talked about the politically incorrect part of this, you know, the Americans with disability stuff. That's the least of it. We got all this other stuff going on. We got people that literally don't know because they haven't been taught. Speak, say, nuh-uh. Lie to them. Tell them all kinds of other things. I'm going to pause right there and just simply say, hey, here's how we wait for a second. We're going to come back and pick up some of the other news and tie the ribbons on this one after we have one more song. But I just want to note, what Ezekiel 44 is telling us is the Levites strayed. Not all of them, a lot of them. And over again, we're seeing this idea of a split. Two houses, north and south, both in exile, both having committed adultery, abominations, idolatry. Neither one is wholly clean or ready. And we're seeing all kinds of evil fruit all over the place. We do need to bring some things back together. Yeah, we need to recognize that, the 80-20 rule, north, 80-20 rule, south, lots of stuff that is at least appropriate, and a whole lot of stuff that's poison, that's worked its way in. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about, riots and some of the other wonderful fruit that comes from the kind of things that children have been taught for far too long. Let's talk about some of the other fruit of exactly what we're seeing, and then what does all of this mean? Because I think that's the real key. And yeah, I already know the answer, and most of you have heard this before. As for us, what we're supposed to do is come out of her. We're supposed to be separate. We're also supposed to make teshuva. When we realize we're on the wrong path, we've been lied to, we've inherited lies from our fathers, as Jeremiah said, well, we do something different. Turn around, go back to him. So here are a couple of the things that are at least signposts along the way, indicators of the time. Remember, men of Issachar, they knew the times and the seasons, so they knew what Israel should do. For crying out loud, it's time to recognize the time and season and know what Israel should do. And here's a piece from WorldNet Daily and Aaron Klein about how the... WorldNet Daily. The media has failed to make a whole bunch of connections when it comes to Boston. Now, if you've been following all this stuff about the Boston riots this week, and I suspect most people have. By the way, give me ones if you've heard about the Boston riots. If there's anybody that hasn't, put some twos up on the screen just so I know where we are. It'll take a while before those appear. But ones and twos. Ones if you've heard about Boston, two if you haven't. And there are a whole lot of things that have come out. I'm going to just cut to the chase and suggest to you, Boston, folks, was planned. Boston was orchestrated. I keep Baltimore. I got the wrong riots in the wrong place. No, Boston was the other false flag. That's where we're going to kill some people and then roust people out of their homes at gunpoint and get them used to a police state. Baltimore is where we're going to get them used to the same thing that Ferguson was breaking them in for. Riots and let's have a civil war and so forth and so on. So we got some twos, okay? Turns out that the mayor of Baltimore admitted... after the fact, what was I? I don't have the quote sitting here in front of me, but yeah, we're going to give people some room to, lie, cheat, steal, break things, burn some things down. Boys will be boys. No, she wouldn't have said that. That would have been called an ethnic slur. Even later on, people that were calling these folks thugs, they were called racist for using a word like thug to describe thugs. Imagine that. Turns out later on that we got a number of police chiefs and sheriffs coming forward and saying, yeah, we were given an order to stand down. They wanted these riots to blow up a little bit. Wonder why. Media fails to identify leader of Baltimore riots. Well, one of them was a fellow named Malik Shabazz, former head of the New Black Panther Party that was out there, essentially, inciting to riot. Dare I use that terminology? Not a single news media outlet, though, says WorldNet Daily, major anyway, CBS, ABC, the propaganda outlets, informed their readers that anything like what a simple Google search of the word Malik Shabazz would show you, and that is that he was the notorious national chairman of the New Black Panther Party, and that they have issued all kinds of extremist things. Now, I guarantee you, folks, if this was somebody that had a constitution and a Bible in his pocket, you'd have heard about all kinds of unsavory things about folks like that. But I guess it's okay to incite to riot. I'm going to end up, well, we'll come back. We'll come back to the riots, because I want to go to some other places first. Set that one aside. In Texas, now there's another set of riots. We got an attempt, I suggest, to get people all primed for the coming police state. There's more and more information, more and more people really upset about this thing that's called Jade Helm. You know the old military saying, you train for what you intend to do. You want to teach people to shoot? You put them on a firing range and you teach them to shoot. Pull the trigger and do the real stuff. You want to teach people to infiltrate? Well, you got to depend. You got to teach them to infiltrate the kind of people you think you're going to go to war against. If you want to teach them to go to war in Afghanistan, you put them in scenarios and training that looks like Afghanistan and looks like the Muslims that are going to be around there and so forth. But if, on the other hand, you're planning something different, why, maybe you set up an operation like Jade Helm and you get them to go into Texas and infiltrate Ma and Pa hardware stores. These people are speaking English, not some other language from some other place in the world. It strains credulity, in other words, to think that you would have a major training exercise going on in the southern United States that would have any purpose other than teaching the military to infiltrate the people that they're going to get ready to go to battle against. How far out of line is that? It's to the point where in Texas, the Texas governor basically has called out their guard to keep a watch over what's happening with Jade Helm 15. Which caused the White House to react this week, and I'm going to call this the Whopper of the Week, but it helps again to put all this in place. Says the White House tried to reassure Americans and the governor of Texas on midweek that this planned U.S. special military training operation for special ops is no cause for alarm. These are not the droids you're looking for. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. No, would we ever lie to you? Have we ever lied to you in the past? If you like your Constitution, you can keep it. These plans, it says, have raised fears among some Texans, those that are conspiracy theorists, obviously, of a federal occupation. So, here you go. White House Press Secretary Josh earnestly told people, you gotta love this quote, talk about a whopper. You gotta wonder if the guy's nose was growing as he was saying this. And I kid you not, I'm gonna read it straight. Quote, in no way will the constitutional rights or civil liberties of any American citizen be infringed upon while this exercise is being conducted, unquote. Give me a break! Does that mean when this exercise is being conducted, they're going to quit the rape of the Bill of Rights that happens in every airport across the country? Are they going to quit doing what they've been working so hard to do, which is to disarm the American people and infringe the right to keep and bear arms? Are they going to quit saying that we have a right to kill you with a drone if we feel like it? Are they going to quit the rape of their right to be free and their persons, houses, papers, and effects of NSA spying and intrusion? Come on! How stupid do they think people are? In no way will the constitutional rights or civil liberties of any American citizen be infringed upon unless we just feel like doing exactly what we've been doing, you silly peon fools, you. We've been getting away with this, haven't we? Meanwhile, the Texas Rangers are saying they're bracing for an ISIS-led invasion. And there's a story from Dave Hodges here about how they are being told in South Texas about all the ISIS folks that are gathering just south of the border. Well, or maybe gathering across the border, because Border Patrol, as you probably are aware, hasn't been stopping anybody. Every now and then, by sheer chance, they happen upon an ISIS guy going across the border. They caught a couple this week, which means there are probably 1,000 that they didn't catch because they've been told not to. The contradictions here, in other words, ought to be extremely eye-opening. Jade Helm is MIA, says another piece from Dave Hodges, as ISIS is literally streaming across the southern border. He says, Judicial Watch, WorldNet Daily, and now his own best sources within the Border Patrol are confirming the fact that what was once illegal border crossings by immigrants from Central America carrying deadly diseases, that's not the big issue now. It's ISIS members. Remember, ISIS is a CIA creation, armed and trained, at least in the Middle East, admittedly, by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, and armed by the military, which rather than destroying weapons, just conveniently allowed them to fall into the hands of enemies. How wonderful is all of this? They're taxpayer armed, in other words. You can't make this stuff up, is the old saying. And he Hodges goes on to point out how since July of last year, these people have been saying things to him privately, like Border Patrol morale was at an all-time low. Officials a year ago were contracting all kinds of diseases, drug-resistant TB, scabies, bacteriological pneumonia. Fellow officers were getting to the point where they were laundering their clothes at work so they wouldn't infect their families because of all the stuff that they were being exposed to. And then in October of last year, these informants informed him that the DHS, and this was confirmed later by the mass media, was confiscating their rifles so that they were defenseless in the face of well-armed Mexican drug cartel incursions, and of course, now ISIS. Border Patrol has been forbidden to arrest and detain suspected ISIS members, just like they're forbidden to do other things that Big Brother doesn't want them to do. That's been since last summer. Any questions? I mean, what is going on here? Well, I think if you connect the dots, it's not that difficult. And I won't even go into it because we don't really have time tonight, but the war on cash, too, is escalating. I could spend a lot of time talking about just how far gone things are economically. This week we had the news about the GDP figures. Basically, they lied. The Bureau of Lying Statistics, actually in this case it's the Bureau of Economic something. What starts with A and means lie. They claim that the U.S. GDP, which was supposed to be, you know, on the mend in the recovery here, in fact came in at 0.2%. That's only the first estimate, though, and as people like former Assistant Treasury Secretary Dr. Paul Craig Roberts have pointed out, there will be two subsequent revisions, and it's a lead pipe cinch that it was really negative, and once the markets get manipulated and have a chance to absorb the bad news and the fact that they've been lied to again, then they'll fess up when nobody's paying attention and they'll say, no, really, it was negative. This is a depression. We've been lying to you for so long. FOMC met this week, and they basically continued the lie. The U.S. dollar collapsed, and then they hammered the precious metals paper markets, hammering gold and silver prices. Hey, for those that are looking to get some, it's being price suppressed. Blue light special, Kmart shoppers. In any case, here we are. We're at the place where the war on cash is now being acknowledged worldwide. Negative interest rates, all of that kind of stuff plays into it. Can you see how the pieces fit together? You've got an operation in southern Texas and in Utah and across other southern states, southwestern states, that's essentially saying, we are going to prepare and train for war on the American people. And then we've got our riots. We had the Ferguson false flag and first test case, beta test. And now we've got the situation in Baltimore. Don't worry, there'll be more coming too. We ordered the stand down. We let that one go for a while. We're just kind of getting our rifles all sighted in here. All the rest of the stuff is playing out right according to plan. Now, here's where I want to end today. I think, hope, you'll find this not only funny, but perhaps at least educational, because it does fit with the Torah portion. And I'm looking at a piece in this regard. From Give Credit Where Credit Is Due. This is from Rabbi Yehoshua Berman. And his
title is, "And From Your Hand Have They Given You." Talks about some of the things that I kind of deliberately glossed over as I was going through Emor, the Torah portion tonight, Leviticus 21 through 24. And he puts it this way. "From your hand they have given you." Towards the end of this parsha, we find an interesting set or organization of mitzvos. Right in the middle of the description of the, what in Hebrew they call this, yamim tovim, respective sacrifices, there is this mitzvah. And we've talked about this before in years past and even recently. You're not to harvest all the corners of your field, right? Remember that? You leave some of the portions of the crop for the poor to take. Now think about that. And same thing goes for the gleanings from your grapes. So we've talked about this. Rashi, he notes, explains that this is about teaching us that the one who gives these gifts to the poor in the proper way is credited as if he had helped to build essentially the Beis Hamikdash himself and brought the appropriate sacrifices. What is all of this? All right, let's pause. Besides being an amazingly inspiring statement, says this teacher, it gives us a sense of the great good that one can achieve if we learn to properly help the poor. And it also kind of begs some explanation. What is it about this mitzvah in particular that is likened to building the Mishkan and bringing the proper sacrifices into this, you know, holy, set-apart place? What do these things have to do with one another? Now, I'm going to skip over some of the detailed explanation and just kind of cut to the chase. There are three different kinds of mitzvot that are talked about here. Leket, Sheshicha, and Peah. They're all mitzvot of leaving something. They all have to do, and we've already mentioned a couple of them, with leaving something behind. Now listen carefully. So that the poor, I'm going to say it somewhat bluntly, can get up off of their bohikas and come on in and harvest it for themselves. They have to do some work. Are you already starting to see where I'm going with this? Contrast this to what's happening in Baltimore. We'll come back to that. Let the poor come and take it. Now we're not talking about breaking down the doors to the Walmart and setting fire to buildings and taking the big screen TVs. No, that's not the only thing that they should be willing to get up off of their you-know-whats and go do. We're talking about provide yourself some daily bread. Get up and go harvest the corners of the fields that have been explicitly left for you. As a matter of fact, he notes, the specific terminology in the Hebrew that the Torah uses here is the word ta'zov, which means to forsake. Now, there's more to it. Rashi says that when you look at the words, it means that the owner of the field must not involve himself in this transaction whatsoever. Think about this. He said just leave the gleanings at the corners of the fields for the poor, period. He is to completely remove himself from the picture and leave it for the poor to take themselves. He doesn't say, oh, you know, you poor guy over there, I want you to come in and get this corner, and you guy over here, no, he's just basically to get the heck out of the way. Why? Ultimately, it's because it's not his. So the Torah is saying that those portions of the crops do not belong to you. They're not your property, Mr. Field Owner. You have no right to them. They already belong to the poor. Just as you have to harvest your field, so are the poor supposed to harvest the part that the Creator of the universe is leaving for them. And that's a little bit different than giving cash directly or doing something directly to subsidize somebody and give them an offering in a whole different way. So, all of this strongly indicates that the highest form of Zedekha, as they put it, is one in which the respective roles of giver and receiver are erased. Do you catch that? I think this is a very important point, and yeah, I think it has a whole heck of a lot to do with what's wrong in places like Baltimore. And hopefully it's all going to come together in just a few seconds. The giver is depicted more as a coincidental courier rather than the source of the beneficence. Let me say that again. It's not as if there is a giver and receiver. Those lines are erased. Guess who the source of the beneficence really is? Ah, hint. Maybe it's the one that wrote the Torah and caused those crops to grow in the field to begin with. So, this is much in line, says the rabbi here, with the precept that the highest form of Zedekha, doing the right thing, righteousness, is helping another to maintain his source of livelihood. Now think of it. Whoa! Contrast that with what's going on in Big Brother's another God-worshipping America with a K, and indeed the whole Western world, based on dishonest weights and measures, and literally, from top to bottom, things that the Torah calls abomination. Draw the contrast. All right, well, we understand, he notes, that this idea of helping another maintain his source of livelihood is about sparing the recipient the embarrassment that comes from receiving what is called the bread of shame. But there's another dimension to this walk that now comes to light. Not only for the beneficiary is it a better form of tzedekah, but it also is better for the benefactor. Because it does not afford him the cause to feel proud. I, from the goodness of my heart, I have done this marvelous thing. I am a philanthropist of the whole first order. I'm even the almighty state. And by my philanthropy, the poor live. If it was not for Washington, you all would be starving. Think about that for a second. Let's cut to the chase. In short, a fundamental underlying idea behind all of these mitzvot here, the different things, right, about leaving the gleanings from your grapevine and not harvesting the corners of your field, all of that is awareness that all of our wealth and all of our prosperity, say it with me, is from Yod Heh Vav Heh, our Creator. And as such, the portions that He has already assigned in His Word to be left for the poor should be viewed as just that. They belong to the poor. They're not ours. Everything, in other words, as they say, is from Hashem. Now, that, by the way, is consistent with the whole rest of Torah, but I'm going to say, wow. Now, let's think about it in the context of where we are today. We got riots because of the entitled classes, right, that basically think that Big Brother owes, no, not Big Brother, you, whoever you happen to be, owe them a living. It is no longer a matter of benefactor and benefactee, of giving and receiving, or of blurring the lines. There is one God. He comes from Washington. He is the source of all goodness. He defines what is right and what is wrong. He legalizes marriage, and He says who is evil and not deserving of a right to worship another God like the one in the Bible. And basically, when people don't get their goodies from Him, well, what are they going to do? They're going to go out and steal them and burn and kill and loot. And they're going to look at all kinds of excuses. Now, discrimination is wrong, right? How dare you discriminate against us? Discernment is what we're really talking about here. Discerning the difference between right and wrong. Discerning the difference between one God and another. Discerning the difference between good and evil. All of that kind of stuff has been done away with. Who is the false God? From whose hand do these blessings flow? We've come so far from Torah, in other words, and from all of the things, well, because we've been told by the Almighty Church, the state license, 501(c)(3) Church of Another God. We've been told all that's done away with, along with your constitution and laws. Hey, if we can do away with the gods, the laws, the instructions of the God of the Bible, your pitiful constitution ain't got a prayer. No pun intended. We got our black robe priests. We're going to rewrite it all. And then we're going to basically say, look, you Levites that have strayed, that have failed to teach my people the difference between right and wrong, between the holy, the set apart, and the unholy, you failed to teach my feasts, my appointed times, you failed to teach your children, you defiled yourself for dead works and dead stuff and dead gods. Is it any wonder, folks, that this portion tonight, Emor, ends with this idea of blaspheming the name of the Almighty? And the penalty thereof is death? Is it death to organizations that claim to be serving God that aren't? Or is it death in a wider scale? There's a whole lot of doublespeak going on in the world today because we've ignored the double speak. Speak to the children. Speak to the priests. Teach your children. Teach the things that I tell you to teach. Teach discernment. Nowadays we call it discrimination. And we teach the exact opposite. I mean, good grief. Yeah, okay. Is there a question on the screen? Go ahead and pop the question up again.
It says, what is the 501c3 keeps talking about? Never
heard of it. Oh, okay. I'm surprised, but that's okay. We got new folks coming all the time. 501c3 is the almighty corporate state designation by Big Brothers IRS for its church. Literally, it's a subsection, and it's a non-profit religious faith-based organization. There was a big stink a while ago because the IRS was basically denying 501c3 status to so-called conservative organizations. They were lining up and saying, oh, pretty please, Mr. God of the Bible? No, I'm sorry, God of Washington? May we have your blessing for our church? We promise we'll be good little slaves. 501c3, in other words, is just simply the statutory designation for a corporate creation that serves another god. But you will not hear it put that way. What you'll hear is, oh, you have to have that tax exemption. Well, you know what? If you read the first article of the Bill of Rights, it says, and I'm quoting, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Well, suppose Congress didn't make a law. Suppose you could get people to sign up for a different kind of law, a whole fake situation based on, oh, start with dishonest weights and measures, and then offer, if they're willing to come on in and make the deal with the devil, offer all kinds of benefits. Now, Congress isn't making laws. These are statutes. They're regulations. They're made by the IRS. Ha ha. In other words, you know, there's a whole lot of ways of lying and getting around. My line for years has been, hey, this just goes to show you what happens when you give crooked lawyers 200 years to work their way cleverly around the explicit prohibitions in the Constitution. Things like thou shall not be infringed. And the real simple answer is, if you can get them to make that deal with the devil, I use the biblical metaphor, to trade their birthright, like Esau did, for a cup of pottage, in for a penny, in for a pound. That's why I was railing against these so-called preachers, not even fit to be Levites, that are worried about their 501c3 tax deduction and leading their congregations right over the cliff in the process. We might have to have civil disobedience. Well, you should have had civil disobedience a long time ago by coming out of her and not participating with all of this stuff. But once you've turned your back on the things he says to keep forever, you got a whole lot of problems. And this is literally where we are.